Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to SFF Addicts, a bi-weekly panel podcast featuring writers from FamFiAddict.com, authors, publishing professionals, bloggers, and more, where we come together to chat about science fiction and fantasy, as well as the occasional jaunt into the wider SFF industry. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and today's episode is my interview with author Nia N.E. Davenport. Nia is the author of The Blood Trials, her debut novel and book one in the Blood Gift duology. I had a great time chatting with her, digging into the world and characters of her new book, as well as touching on its geopolitical and racial themes. Also, she has a wicked sense of humor, so hopefully you can laugh along with us. All right, now on to my interview with Nia Davenport. Here we go. All right. Welcome, everybody, to another author chat on the podcast. And today I have the pleasure of being joined by Nia N.E. Davenport. She's the author of The Blood Trials, her debut novel and the first book in the Blood Gift duology, which is due out on April 5th. She's also an English and biology teacher, striving to make a difference in the lives of young people and help minimize disparities in education for youth of color. And building on that, she's an advocate for diverse perspectives and protagonists in literature, something I'm wholeheartedly on board with, and she does an amazing job of incorporating that into The Blood Trials. So welcome, Nia. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And first off, congratulations on the soon-to-be-release of your book. How does it feel?
It's been a really long journey, so it feels super amazing, and I'm thrilled, and I just hope everybody loves it as much as I do.
Well, that's the hope, but I mean, I read the book, and I loved it, so I think you're off to an amazing start. And before we delve deeper into The Blood Trials, I want to ask you a bit more about you, yourself. When did you first start reading sci-fi and fantasy, and how did that progress as you got older?
I think the question is, when did I not? I'm like thinking back to like when I was like little, like maybe like 4 or 5 or 6. And I'm like, if you want to count like the old school, like Goosebumps and Fear Street. And I think I remember being like 10 and picking up like Peter Straub's Ghost Story. So I'm like, I've read sci-fi and fantasy literally my entire life. I think just like as I got older, I went from like watching sci-fi and fantasy to reading more and more of it to being like, this is so cool. I want to write sci-fi and fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Well, shout out to Goosebumps. I love that series so much. And how did you just mentioned you wanted to write science fiction and fantasy after reading, watching it and consuming it for throughout your youth. But how did that transition happen? And, you know, when were you starting to write more concrete stories?
I think it happened, it's been so long. If it's 2022, it happened right around like 2009. I was graduating from college, and I think I stumbled upon L.A. Banks's Vampire Huntress Legend. And I've talked about this before, but it was the first time I saw like a Black woman in like a speculative work. And I was like, oh, this is a thing. And I'm like, I'm sure there was tons before, but like 21-year-old me, it was the first, you know, one that like I saw. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is so dope. Like, this is so cool. And that's like kind of what got the gears turning. And I, at the time, I was reading tons of like urban fantasy. And I found myself like reading the stories and devouring them and being like, if I was writing this, I would, you know, change this ending or I'd do this thing with this character or I'd like tweak this plot twist. And just at some point, I feel like around like 23, 24, I came to the position. I was like, you know what? I keep saying I would. And I was like, I want to try and see if I can actually I do it. I think the first novel I attempted to draft, it was back then, writing a full-length novel felt like this huge like hurdle. And I'm like, how do I get to like 90K? How do I get to like 100K? I'm like struggling to get to like 20K. And I'm like, how do authors do this? And I think I wrote half of it. I put it down. I went back to it like 2 or 3 years later, like, okay, I'm legit going to do this again. I started back from like the very beginning. And like before I knew it, like I spent the summer and I had like a 90K. I mean, it was 90K of like vomit, but I'm like, I learned that like I could actually get a full length sci-fi fantasy novel out. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it was just a process of like reading like tons of craft books. And like, I began like picking up novels for enjoyment, but also to like study and pick apart, you know, their first chapters and like their plot structure and the choices they make for characterization and world building and setting. So I was very much a learn by reading and learn as I go type of writer. And then I guess fast forward like about 6 years ago, I drafted a YA fantasy that was a Hades and Persephone retelling, and that's a novel I queried that got my agent. And we put that on submission, but it ended up not selling. And while I was waiting on my agent to offer rep, I wrote The Blood Trials. It was kind of like my project of, so I'm not like this hot, anxious mess, right, while I'm waiting on a response. Yeah. I started drafting The Blood Trials as like, okay, I know if this novel doesn't, if the YA doesn't get me an agent, I'm working on this new thing, and I can query with that. And I remember when I talked to my agent about the novel she signed me with, she was asking what I had next. I pitched her The Blood Trials, and she was like, that sounds really good, and I can't wait to read it. By the time she offered rep, I had already had like a first draft cranked out. I think we put it aside to like get the YA on submission. And again, once that was on sub, I went back to The Blood Trials to revise it so we could try to sell that. Like, okay, if the first one doesn't sell, I'm working on something else. And that, like, I guess The Blood Trials just ended up being like the ordained, like magic, predestined book that was meant to be my debut. Because my agent read it. I remember her reading it and being like, this is amazing. And then my sister, who reads tons of sci-fi fantasy, she read it and was like, this is it. This is the book that's going to get sold. And it was.
But you played it very smart. I mean, a lot of the time, you know, when people go the traditional route, they write something and often put all their eggs in that one basket, you know, even write a sequel to it or two sequels or whatever. And they end up getting fucked over because, you know, it doesn't sell. And then what are you left with? You know, so you played it really smart. And I love that you just went for it with this. And The Blood Trials, I mean, as a debut, I really loved it. And it comes across as very strong and it has a distinct voice that, you know, I'm excited to see what else you put out in the future. And I'm also curious, you know, you mentioned this YA novel, you finished it, put it out on submission, everything, weren't getting any bites, but you'd already started to work on The Blood Trials. How did that initial idea come about? And did you originally plan it as a duology or was it a single book at the beginning?
I originally planned it as a trilogy. It got bought as a duology. That's a whole nother story. Drafting the sequel was hell because I had to like condense a book two and book three into just a book two. Everything that I had up for book one. But The Blood Trials itself came about. I wrote it right after the hell that was the 2016 election. And it was just, it was part me channeling my frustrations and my rage into like a sci-fi fantasy novel. And it was also part me being like disillusioned with the fact that my YA on sub wasn't selling. And it was me being like, F it, I'm literally gonna pour, like, I no longer care like if I'm creating a story that might be marketable or that might be sellable. It was like, I'm literally about to pour every trope and every like plot device and like every aspect of science fiction fantasy that I love. I'm just putting it all into this book and I'm going to see what I end up with.
No, and it's awesome because, I mean, I've heard from so many writers, write what you want to read, not necessarily what the market or what the publishers are looking for. It's like, if you have the passion and you really love this thing and you put all of it into it and you throw in all the tropes that you love, you're just like, oh man, I don't give a shit what anybody thinks about this, but this is like my love and this is my passion. And if you own it, if you own the tropes, if you own the passion, if you own the characters and everything like that, people are going to read that and they're going to love it just as much as you. Obviously they're going to connect with it in different ways, but that comes out very much in your book.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah. I remember drafting it and then having a convo with my agent where I was like, I'm terrified that this isn't going to sell, because I was like, I did three like huge no-nos. Like at the time back in 2016, I'm like, it was during that whole wave where like sci-fi was supposedly a hard sell. So I'm like, I technically wrote a pseudo-sci. I didn't just write a sci-fi. I wrote like a science fantasy, which is supposed to be an extra hard sell. Right. I'm like, I also put a black woman lead, which was also at the time publishing was telling us that's hard. So I mean, it was total BS at the time, and we know it now too. But we were getting that, and then yeah. I think also like adult fantasy is supposed to be just incredibly hard to like break into in general. So I remember like calling my agent and being like, I think I just like fucked up tremendously, and like this book isn't gonna sell either because I just did three things that publishing is like, no, don't do that.
No.
Right. And my agent, she's awesome. Katie Flum and Liza Dawson Associates. She was like, fuck that and fuck them. And like, you're awesome. And if this is what you want to do, we're going to like rock and roll with this project. And I was like, it is. So let's roll that die.
No. And I mean, I think, like I said earlier, I think that shows is like, it pays off when authors put their all into things and don't necessarily bow to the risks, because any creative endeavor is a risk, but it's like, you need to just own it and make it your own. And the attention will come from that. It's like, I am writing my own novel, and it's like, no part of me is ever thinking like, oh, is this working for the market? Or is this like what traditional publishers want or anything like that? I'm just like, no, I want to write this novel and I want to read this novel, and it's weird. And I want this thing, like you said earlier, to go from like 90K, 100K vomit to something that's publishable and just see what happens, you know?
Yes, for sure.
And you mentioned your protagonist, her name's Akenna. And how did she come into the picture of the blood trials? And for her specifically, her thrust is this revenge mystery story arc, trying to figure out who killed her grandfather. It's not a spoiler. That's what kicks off the novel. And it should be the kind of thing that really hooks people in. And it did for me. So when did she come into the picture, and why did that story arc in particular play so well to her and her personality?
So I think Akenna came about before the story arc and the plot came about. I found that I was drawn to like female protagonists that were like cocky and arrogant, but like had like the ferocity and like the battle skills to back up their arrogance. And that like were angry, but were like had like a legitimate reason to be angry and kind of just like approach the world with a like fuck you, fight me, right? type of attitude, which Akenna totally has. So. She's like, fight me, and you're not gonna fuck win.
Yeah.
So she came to me fully formed in that way. One of my favorite protagonists ever is Alona Andrews, Kate Daniels books. Kind of has that like F you fight me energy, right? And it's one of my favorite urban fantasy series, and one of my favorite protagonists ever. And so Akenna came to me wanting to be just from the fact that I love that energy in like a female protagonist. So I was like, okay, this is who I want. So now what type of world and like what type of like plot arc do I drop her in to where it feels organic and natural? And that type of like brash personality can like really shine through. Because I feel like it's a fine line between her being like dislikable and like just chaotic, and her having like you know, a righteous cause when she's like, you know, fuck you, fight me. So I'm like, what type of world do I put her in to where she, you know, walks the line of like righteous, like anger, and like she's just in seeking her vengeance. And so then I remember, I'm a teacher, so I teach Othello every year. And with my students, we always talk about how like Othello, depending on who reads it and how you choose to interpret it, you can very much read Othello as a Black man who is in a predominantly non-Black society, or at the very least a dark-skinned man who is in a predominantly non, you know, who is in a society that predominantly doesn't reflect his identity. And he rises to become this great hero and like war general. But he gets a lot of hatred. And he gets a lot of like jealousy thrown his way, especially from characters like Iago, who's like, you don't deserve this, even though he does. I'm like, he works his ass off, and like he has like, yeah, you know, the like military battles and might to back it up, but they're like, you don't deserve this. So Akena's world and conflict came about me thinking about Othello and teaching it from the lens that I do, and being like, okay, what if the story wasn't about an Othello figure, himself, what if the story is about the granddaughter of that type of Othello figure? So like Othello lives and he becomes this great war hero who like he has to be given power like to protect everybody else. And but what if like I kind of like mesh like Othello and Julius Caesar together, right? So I'm like, what if like Othello, this Othello figure, his like cabinet of generals are incredibly racist and incredibly jealous that, you know, he's risen to this extreme position of privilege and power over them, despite them feeling like, you know, they are, you know, the, I guess, the end all be all, like they should sit at, you know, the supreme head of society. Yeah. And what if, you know, this cabinet murders him, and the story isn't about, you know, this male Othello figure, but it's about this female grandchild that he leaves behind and that he's raised up in his like legacy of military greatness. And who's kind of like, at the beginning, Akena has kind of fed into the indoctrination, right? That her, and this isn't a spoiler, I'm like, it's in chapter one, that like she lives in the greatest country that there is. And like, you know, they're the best of the best, and they're the elite of elite. And she loves her country at the beginning, despite all of the racism that she faces. So what if like, she finds out that all the things she loves about it, is kind of like, I guess, tainted by like, once she unearths, like right there in chapter one, that this country and this cabinet of generals that was supposed to be fiercely loyal and owed her grandfather everything, including their lives, they murder him. And that kind of sets her on her path to be like, hell no, something needs to be done to set this straight.
And it works so well.
And of course, she's Akena, and she's totally the type of character who's like, I'm gonna like stab or shoot first and ask all the necessary questions later, because that's who exactly she is. She automatically pivots to the thing that can set this straight is, I'm gonna murder them all.
No, but it's perfect, because it, I love that you used Othello as a, as an example, as sort of like a reference point, jumping off on that and thinking about like, you know, what would the grandchild, the granddaughter of this prominent figure be like, you know, but with all the training and everything incorporated into their life for such a long period of time, but also, like you said, the indoctrination. And it's like her maturity and her personality are not necessarily at the same level of her martial skills or her you know, combat and military mm-hmm. skills and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of cool to see, like, over the course of the novel, her personality, it's just coming to so many choke points. Like you said, she just says like, fuck you, I'm going to shoot first and ask questions later. But I love the way that you gave her this progression arc, where it's like, okay, she has this insane physical military martial ability, but her personality, she's really immature and brash and
she is
you know, fiery in a lot of ways. And to see those two kind of like even out and merge together is awesome. And you brought up a ton of points that I want to bring up a little bit later, but first, you know, you mentioned earlier that you blended science fiction and fantasy for the world of the Blood Trials. You know, how did you then incorporate that into the world building and geopolitics? And why was that science fiction fantasy blend so fitting for what you created?
I think it's because when I sat down to like create the world and the politics and, you know, the like, you know, the backstory and the history and the present, I really like the aesthetic of tech and, you know, where tech in the future will take us. But I also really like the aesthetic of magic and like those tried and true like fantasy tropes of, you know, I guess the age old like clash of like feuding like clash of different kingdoms and territories who are fighting for power, who are fighting for magic, who are maybe coming to like grips with you know, the magical haves versus the magical have nots. So I think those were like the fantasy elements that I really enjoy reading. So I wanted to put in the Blood Trials. But also I think it was a point where I sat down to draft, I actually had to ask my question, like, what does this setting look like? Is it secondary world? Is it on, is it alternate Earth? Is it somewhere in space? Is it, you know, old world feeling? Is it new world feeling? Is it futuristic feeling? And we just talking about The Force Awakens. I had just watched The Force Awakens. I've been a huge Star Wars fan since I've been like a little girl. And I was like, I really like the way that like Star Wars has that like duality of like the mysticism of the Force, and versus, and like, you know, like the sci-fi futuristic feeling. So that's how that kind of like meshed together in the Blood Trials. And I was like, I don't want this to be set on Earth. I really like, you know, the idea of like this being a far off distant planet in a distant galaxy that has, you know, these human like, you know, or these human adjacent mortals have evolved. I love anything that deals with like mythology and lore and the gods. So then the gods came into play because I was like, well, how did they even get there? And I'm like, well, obviously gods did. Like this, like, you know, this pantheon of terrible gods. because I'm like, we need a reason for like why they have this magic in the first place. And so the story is very much, I don't think I intentionally set out to make it a conversation of the clash between magic and tech, and like godly might and like human technological advancement. But just as I wrote it, that's kind of where like, you know, the geopolitics took me once I started asking questions. Okay, well, if this planet is split into different nations and kingdoms and republics, well, why are they split? And if they're feuding, why are they feuding? And if, you know, magic in one place is illegal and magic in another place isn't, then why? And then I just kind of arrived at the solution that, well, there were these gods. And again, this is not a spoiler, but there were these gods. They were terrible, like all gods are, right? And like happens at some point in the history, the people got fed up and said, to hell with this, and, you know, rose up against them. And then that became my explanation for like why magic is strongly rejected in certain territories on the planet that the Blood Trials is set in, and why it's rejected to the extent that people like Akenna and her nation have been like hunted to literal extinction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the way that you incorporated it into your world building for me felt very cohesive. You know, you mentioned how the magic and all that just kind of played naturally into the geopolitics, but I love how you have that contrast between this very technological society where magic is illegal, and there's also sort of blatant discrimination, or I don't know how you would call like racism mm-hmm. towards magic users, but it also has to do with skin color because
right.
she is from a nation where the skin color is darker, and all of this just plays so naturally into the geopolitics of things that you have this nice duality between magic and science, magic and technology, but also the geopolitics of these nations, you know, the technological society versus the one that is more, how would I say it? More humble and accepting of, of magic and how it can be incorporated into culture. And then Ikenna, she has, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this personality progression as she's uncovering what happened to her grandfather. But at the same time, she's coming to understand her mixed race heritage and the conflict, the conflict that comes from that, and the way that magic is sort of this secret in her life and how that unfolds. I won't spoil anything there because I think that's one of the best parts of the book. But you include magic and you include the fantastical elements in contrast to the technological elements in this way that, from my perspective, created a discussion around some pretty complex political themes, you know, things like America's foreign policy or overseas wars, and like the military industrial complex is a big thing that I kind of plucked out of the book, especially from the way the more technologically centric society, you know, their schemes are unfolding throughout the book. So for you, why did you decide to include these more political discussions and kind of cast them in the light of this cool, magical, fantastical, technological world?
This is one of those things where I feel like there's like two answers. There's like a totally like esoteric scholarly answer. And then there's like a completely like blunt truth answer.
Give me both.
Okay. So the esoteric answer is that, you know, sci-fi and fantasy, one of the best things about it is that it's reflective of real life, right? And the real life, you know, political and social challenges and themes and conversations going on, you know, around us. And yes, to an extent, I did sit down to write the blood trials to dissect and examine and have a discussion about those real life political and social challenges. Like, I wanted to dissect misogyny. I wanted to dissect racism. I wanted to dissect what it looks like when you literally take child soldiers and indoctrinate them from very young and raise them up. And, you know, the trauma and the violence that, you know, is being visited upon them. I also wanted to examine what it looks like for, I guess, people who serve a country and who love a country, but they're not necessarily reflected by the majority of the country, if that makes sense, and they're not necessarily wholly loved yeah. back, and what it looks like for that individual to still, you know, have a fierce sense of duty and allegiance. Because without spoiling it, Ikenna comes, you know, her duty and allegiance for her country that, you know, she's not the majority, she doesn't reflect the majority, right? It comes to a head in the book where she has to figure out, you know, do I make a decision that, you know, backs my allegiance to my country, or do I make a decision that potentially, you know, casts me as like a traitor? And I feel like looking at like the American military and PLC and marginalized populations that serve within our American military, you know, when they're, you know, engaged in foreign conflicts or whatever, you know, they may have some of those same like conversations. And I know it's conversations that, you know, I'll have with like friends and families and colleagues and even in like the teaching sphere. Right. So that's the esoteric answer, right? That's like the scholarly answer. Art is reflective of real life. And so I definitely sat down to everything that I thought of with the relationships between the world and the military and Ikenna. It definitely had you know, took like seeds in, like took root in real life. But also the blunt truth answer is a lot of it just developed organically without me intentionally saying I want to hit, you know, X, Y, and Z and make sure I talk about this within the novel. To be completely honest, I sat down and was like, I just want to write a badass, fierce heroine who is trained in this military world, because I was like, how cooler does it get than this like super soldier who has, you know, these crazy, like powerful, like combat skills. And so I was like, I just want to write a woman who's a badass fighter and a soldier. And I want to put I love X-Men. And I was like, I want to, you know, populate her with like biologically enhanced super soldiers around her. And 300 is a movie I really like a lot, actually. And I really like the idea, like that scene we got in Sparta where like we saw the training montage, right, of them taking these children and like literally like indoctrinating them and like beating into them, literally the fact, which right. Akina and her crew literally is beating into them. Your job is to be a warrior. Your job is to be a soldier. Your job is to, you know, protect Marine. And, you know, come like life or death, if you can't be the best of the best as far as like combat and fight prowess goes, then you're worth nothing to us, right? And so I wanted that. And then I also, I'm like, obviously, if I populate it with these children, they're literally kids, right? They're 19, where like they're raised to be killers, you kind of end up stepping into them being petty and vicious and completely immature, and you're handing them this great power and responsibility. But I'm like, I shamelessly leaned into, you know, the antics and the humor and a little bit of the crassness that you would naturally get if you like take a 19-year-old, because I remember myself at 19, right? When you take a 19-year-old and like tell them they're like badass and give them all of this like military power and like training and all of this privilege and status and like money, I'm like, you're gonna get outlandish, right? Arrogant, brash behavior across the board from a lot of the characters, which you do. So I just wanted to have fun. I'm like, really? I just want to populate Akina and her world with soldiers, and I wanted the different territories to be at war, because I really like when books give me a history where like the current clashes are informed by a lot of petty and non-petty feuds that have just like spilled over and snowballed throughout time, to where it's like, oh shit, when these two people meet or when these two parties meet, we know something is going to pop off. Like we know something is going to detonate, right? I guess the long answer to what you asked, the blunt truth is, I really just wanted to paint like a thrilling, fun story that was about like war and fighting, but also like some of the characters, like they fall in love, and about like feuds and like vicious brawls. And that leaned into like the gore and the horror. And that's how the blood trials, like all the different aspects came to be. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I will say, you did the ensemble cast is definitely something that I want to touch upon, but you also condense that petty feud kind of nature into the hot and bothered romantic sexy elements, and I love that too, so yeah. And it felt like, oh god, it's like I remember when I was 19 and I was definitely a fucking child. I was not an adult at 19 years old. And just imagining having all that power, then it's just like, oh, oof, oh, yeah. And you're a teacher, so you see it even more. It's just like, you think you're about growing up, but you are not.
And I feel like Akina and her ensemble crew, they definitely learn that throughout the book. Like, you think you're an adult, but you're not.
Nor you are get you challenged, acting like, and life is going to smack you across the face. But when it comes to that ensemble cast, how did you go about managing the various characters while also making them distinct and relatable, but also kind of tying in to Ikenna's perspective and her progression as a character.
That's another thing that's just kind of like, I'm a huge pantser, so none of this was actually plotted beforehand. It was more so like coming to like being like, you know, Ikenna's two best friends, they got created as I was writing chapter one. I dropped her in a bar and I was like, she needs like people who are her people. But I did go at it a little bit strategically, wanting to show different aspects of Ikenna's highly stratified world. So one of her friends, Celine, she got created because I wanted to show Ikenna occupies her world in a, she admittedly a position of privilege and status, right? But she's not without prejudice and bigotry. So Ikenna walks this like in between line. Whereas Celine was the epitome of someone occupying the world like 100% firm footing on the side of like status and power and like privilege. And she's other than the fact that she's a woman and is incredibly sexist and patriarchal society. She has the skin color. She has the high pedigree. Her father is literally like one of the elite generals. So she has it all. So Celine was my character to show that aspect, but also made her a woman so that her and Ikenna could kind of like commiserate and identify that even though Celine checks off all the other boxes, the fact that she's a woman, she's still gonna get shit. Maybe not on Akina's level, but she still is going to get shit in this highly patriarchal world. And she still has her own challenges that she's gonna have to like tackle. Akina's other best friend is this guy named Zane. He's, you know, coded as this white boy in like this world. And he has the skin color, right? But what he doesn't have is the pedigree. He comes from lower means. And I made those choices for him to show a duality between Ikenna, this black woman who has, you know, the economic status. And I guess the, yeah, she has the economic status and she has the position, but she doesn't have, you know, I guess the acceptance, the full acceptance that would come by being the right skin color. Whereas her best friend Zane, you know, he checks off all the boxes to be in the quote unquote like good old boys club, right? Except he doesn't have the money. He doesn't have the pedigree. And so I feel like I put Ikenna, Zane, and Celine in constant conversation with each other about what does a true seat at the table look like? What does true power wielded and, you know, handed over look like? And they each occupy a position of privilege and power in some way, while also being like having, you know, being like prejudiced, like experiencing a wall of prejudice and, you know, I guess being like shut out in a different way. So that's how those three characters came to be. And I think my subconscious kind of created that duality from a conversation I had with a guy in a college class. I took like a world cultures intro class when I was a freshman. And my socioeconomic status is very like upper middle class. I had parents who worked very hard, you know, to, you know, provide for me and my siblings, you know, very relatively cushy lives. And I remember getting into a debate with a white guy in that class who tried to tell me that the fact that I was, you know, upper middle class meant that, you know, I would get way more like opportunities and privileges in life that he would ever get. Because he, you know, he was like, you know, from a lower like socioeconomic class. And so I think maybe my subconscious was like playing out that conversation and, you know, right, dissecting. I remember at the time being like, you're out of your mind. Absolutely not. So Ikenna definitely has those types of conversations with her peers. And I really wanted to lean into that because I feel like those are the types of conversations that young adults around that 19, you know, 20 year old age, just on the cusp of adulthood, are like having. And it's conversations that me at 35, I still have with, you know, my peers, and, you know, my parents are 60. Yeah. They still have it with, you know, among their peers. And then the rest of the cast just kind of came into being. I'm like, you have your standard Chance. I'm sorry, I'm getting my name
douchebag
mixed up, but like Hyman is your standard, like, bro, frat boy, who, our golden boy that has it all, right? But even he, without spoilers, you know, has his character arc along the way. And then you have, you know, the great protege of Akina's grandfather, who is set up to be like another form of our golden boy. But again, I can't talk about Reed too much without giving like a huge spoiler. But it's funny. I think of, he's the character, Darius Reed, Akina's protege and potential love interest. He's the character that is always the moral compass in my head. And I remember saying that on Twitter, and one of my advanced readers coming into my mentions and being like, that was supposed to be your moral compass? He's as terrible as the rest of them, maybe just a little bit less terrible. And I was like, oh. I'm like, he's the one that's like, maybe let's slow down and not, you know, jump off the ledge to do this horrible thing.
I mean, I understand it, because like the society overall, like you said, they've been indoctrinated. So it's like, yeah, shit's pretty fucked up. And this guy is the moral compass within this like totally messed up framework, you know? And like you say, he says, you know, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should like, step back, or just think about a little bit more, slow down, whatever have you. He still does some pretty terrible stuff, but it's more like he's like the least terrible person in a pretty terrible circumstance and like world. So I do agree with you, but then I also agree with your advanced reader. So
like that's your moral compass, really? That's who you got?
But I love it that you have these, you know, you have your trio and they balance each other out really well. And I think you explained sort of like your conception for them as a group super well. And then at the same time, you have all these characters around them. And one of the things that I really love, because it's very reflective of Akina's personality, like this fight first mentality, is the way that you incorporate combat into the book. And a lot of the times it's like conversations are had over a fight, which is not something you see all the time, but it's like really, it works really well, because the conversation is flowing in a way that is fluid because of the fluid nature of the combat itself. So it's like the conversation's flowing, but the combat is also flowing, and you just have really great fight scenes that are tense and effective. So how did you go about doing the fight scenes and the combat? And do you have any martial arts training? Cause I think you did a very good job of just portraying that throughout the book. This is like, no, I
have none, but like I said, I am a none. I really like urban fantasy, like a lot. And I feel like urban fantasy has had some of the best fight scenes and combat scenes that I have ever read in any, like, you know, body of books. So a lot of it was just leaning into and studying fight scenes from former books that I've read and that I've loved. And also, I remember attending a workshop at a Sirens convention. It's one of my favorite conventions to go to. It's a science fiction fantasy convention that's put on for women and non-binary individuals every year in Colorado. And I attended this workshop where it was the anatomy of a fight scene. And the main takeaway I got was, when you're blocking out a fight scene, you shouldn't just be, you know, like describing, you know, hit here, punch here, kick here. Writing a fight scene is a lot like writing a sex scene. You shouldn't just be describing the moving parts. You should also be like, the true magic of a fight scene is when you're showing the little things that the point of view character is picking up on and thinking in like the heat of the battle. And so I really focus on weaving that together with, yes, blocking out the cool, like, you know, punches and kicks being hurled and daggers being hurled and things, but also making sure to weave in how every movement, like every attack or assault or defensive maneuver, link back to Akena's psyche and Akena's personality, or, you know, her opponent's psyche and personality. And I feel like I did a pretty good job of every, like, attack or counter attack is very much indicative of, like, the two combatants' personalities. Like, Akena is, yeah, 9 times out of 10, she's gonna go on the offensive, like, and she's gonna come out with guns blazing, and throw everything she's got in like to it right off the back. But also, she's also constantly, you know, her grandfather was this extreme, like, exceptional martial artist, so she's always. Her fight scene shows you she's not as reckless as, you know, she appears to be, because she's constantly thinking and analyzing on a strategic level when she's fighting. Mm-hmm. So that's how I try to weave those things together.
Yeah. But the balance was good. I mean, you did from my perspective, a good job, because the fight scenes were kind of like vehicles for character development and character relationships a lot of the time, because you even have friends who fight each other, you know, even from like a friendly perspective. And I love that. It's just like, you know, instead of like, hey, let's go play video games together, it's like, no, let's go beat the shit out of each other. And we'll just heal it up. And, right. And that's how we do it, you know? And so that was indicative of just like the that was just like indicative of the combative nature of this society. And then at the same time, like you say, Akena's very, very brash. She's very fiery. She gets heated a lot of the time, and often very quickly, depending on who she's interacting with or who she's talking to. But when it comes to combat, she does reflect more of her grandfather in that she's much more methodical, and she at least kind of looks for people's tells and looks for their weaknesses in a way that's very indicative of her strategic side. And I imagine later on in the second book, we're going to get to see more of her progression on that front, like what she's like as sort of this leader, what she's like as a strategic head of, I won't spoil anything, whatever she's going into. So yeah, I thought you had a great representation of that. You balanced it really well. And I'm surprised that you don't have any martial arts background, because you nailed it with the action in this book.
I just, like I said, I like a lot of science fiction and fantasy, and I think I always gravitate to books and movies and shows where the characters are warriors in some shape or form, and where there's always some type of fight, amazing dynamic fight scenes going on. I'm very much a learn by doing, a learn by seeing and reading type of writer. Yeah.
And that fits into you being a pantser, and I applaud you for that, because I cannot fucking pants for my life. It's just like, I need to have at least like some conception of what's going on when I go into a chapter or a scene. But I just mentioned the sequel to The Blood Trials. Do you have any non-spoilery things that you can tell viewers and listeners about that, as well as what the future holds for you as a writer?
So I'm the worst person with spoilers, so this may take me a minute. I'm like, my friends fucking me all the time. Non-spoilery things. Now, Kenna continues her arc, the arc that gets set up in book one. She, you know, continues that same type of path and, you know, grows by leaps and bounds by the end of book two. She's going to have to reckon with who she is. And I think if book one was about vengeance and, you know, learning to really figure out where your own strengths lie outside of whatever indoctrination, and where your own values lie inside of whatever indoctrination, I think book two the main theme is, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Akena having to figure out, I think even from, I guess, the book jacket summary is not a spoiler, that she has an incredible amount of both magical power and just like combat power, right? More than most, more than probably everybody except for a few select. And Akena having to figure out where she fits or if she even fits in the world with the amount of power that she has, and walking the line of, okay, what, how do I exercise it? What do I do with it without, you know, descending into the type of oppressive regime or, you know, the type of evil that I have, that I'm fighting against, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, that was great. And I'm very, very excited to see how her story unfolds in book two. And do you think, I mean, not sure what the current plans are, but hopefully that will be released next year.
Yeah, the plans are definitely to release it in 2023. I cannot say exactly when in 2023, but I think it's going to be early part of 2023 as opposed to late 2023. Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. I'm like, I've already turned it in. I turned it in February 1st. So I'm waiting on edits from, waiting and terrified. I have a wonderful editor, David Pamerica over at Harper Voyager. I feel like he, even from the start, he's kind of like guiding the work and the vision like no other. Like he gets that I'm trying to, you know, tell a story with some pretty weighty things, but I also, he definitely helps me and supports me when I lean into the the humor and the shenanigans and you know, to because I feel like both of those components, and the pettiness. I'm like, both of those components make up the Blood Trials. It's a serious book as much as it's just like a fun romp, right? And so, yeah, I turned it in February 1st. I'm waiting on edits. I'm assuming I will spend the summer working on edits and it'll be out early 2023.
Awesome. Cool. I cannot wait for that. And to close out,
thank you.
If you could share with viewers and listeners what you're currently reading, watching, listening to that you could recommend to them.
Okay. Oh, wow. I always get this and I get put on the spot because I'm like, it's like things always empty out of my head. Okay.
You're
so
telling me before we started that you're watching The Force Awakens.
Yeah, so I just watched The Force Awakens for the first time since it was released. I just finished streaming The Gilded Age on HBO, which is amazing. I'm working my way through Altered Carbon and The Foundation as well. Nice. As far as reading, audiobook, I'm reading The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue by V.E. Schwab, which is a whole experience. Cool. The physical book I'm reading right now is The Unbroken by C.L. Clark. It's another book that's about an individual raised in a very militaristic lifestyle. That's literally my main jam in science fiction fantasy. And then the ebook I'm reading is, I took a break from two heavier books. The ebook I'm reading is a really cute and amazing YA rom-com called Charming as a Verb that's about this young Black kid who grows up in New York trying to navigate. He's a young Black kid who bears a Haitian identity, and he grows up in New York trying to navigate going to this school with all these rich kids and not being rich himself, and trying to, like, his dream is to get into Columbia, and he's trying to navigate, how do I get into my dream school when I don't have, you know, necessarily all of the connections and, you know, nepotism that my peers do. And he falls in love with this really adorable girl along the way. I'm like a two-brained, like literally I love rom-coms as much as I love science fiction fantasy. So I'm generally always reading both of them at the same time and watching both of those types of genres at the same time.
I mean, I fully appreciate that you have this sort of balance, because for me, it's like, I need to just sort of mix things up a little bit. I need to have like some fantasy, some sci-fi, nonfiction, you know, maybe something that's like a little more humorous. If I just have like oversaturation of any one genre, I just kind of go crazy a little bit. But The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue and The Unbroken are definitely on my TBR list. And I'm very excited to get it.
I also noticed that my fantasy, yes, they are phenomenal. And science fiction tastes skewed dark and heavy. So I also always need to like throw a rom-com in after a sci-fi read to like lighten my life and my mind. Yeah. Cause I'm like, I just went on a whole depressing
cleanse.
Gory, death-filled journey. We need some light and some love for a minute.
Of course. Oh, man.
Even writing, I feel like I have to strike that balance. I finished A Blood Gift and I was like, okay, I need to write something lighter because I just spent like 600 pages with like death and more death.
With a little bit of humor, some sex, it's all good. You
know? With a little bit of humor thrown in there.
Oh, man. Well, Nia, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Honestly, I had a blast. And if you could please tell viewers and listeners where they can find you on social media and where they can pick up the blood trials as well. And when?
Sure. Social media, on Twitter, I am Nia_Davenport. On IG, Instagram, I'm Nia.Davenport. My website is www.nedavenport.com. The Blood Trials for U.S. readers comes out Tuesday, April 5th. You can pick it up at any of your beloved indie bookstores or any of, you know, any other retailers as well. For UK, I believe it comes out April 14th, and same, you can pick it up at any of your indies or other retail outlets.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I really appreciate you inviting me. This was amazing and so much fun.
There we have it. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Nia Davenport. You can also check out my review for The Blood Trials over on fanfiatic.com, and I'll include a link to that in the episode description. If you like this episode, please subscribe, rate and review us on your platform of choice, and share us with your friends. It helps a lot and we greatly appreciate it. You can follow SFF Addicts on Twitter or Instagram at sffaddictspod for updates and more, or shoot us an email at sffaddictspod@gmail.com. You can also follow me, Adrian M. Gibson, on Twitter or Instagram at Adrian M. Gibson. SFF Addicts is part of fanfiatic.com, so make sure to check us out there for the latest in book reviews, essays, and all things sci-fi and fantasy, as well as the full episode archive for the podcast. All music comes courtesy of the talented Astronauts. Check them out on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/STRONOZ. All links for the episode are also available in the show notes. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.